across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Money, very much on the Nolan Show's agenda today. The Prime Minister, later in the programme, you'll hear him set out what he has described as painful decisions on the way for the country in terms of the budget and the government decisions around raising revenue. What we're doing today is focusing on Stormont. What are they going to do? And what decisions are they going to make? And the Prime Minister, within his speech, you'll hear him say he didn't want to means test winter fuel payments, but he had to do it. Stormont still hasn't made a decision. So at what point are we going to hear from our leaders in Stormont about the decisions that they need to make about our lives here in Northern Ireland? All coming up this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Northern Ireland's public finances are under intense pressure with two government ministers, Paul Given and Mike Nesbitt. Paul is the Education Minister, Mike is the Minister for Health. Both Paul Given and Mike Nesbitt indicating that they may have to overspend this year, and the overspends could total hundreds of millions of pounds. Now, that could have consequences for us in the future, because if you overspend one year, you've got to pay it back. You've got to pay it back to the British government. So overspends are a very important part, should be an important part of our conversations here in our community in Northern Ireland. So why is this at the top of our show this morning? Because you will have heard last week us reporting how the Permanent Secretary for the Department of Justice, Hugh Wittes, intervened and warned the Chief Constable, John Boucher. Boucher had said that he was going to overspend, that he had no choice but to overspend because he doesn't have enough to do the basics. So what did the Permanent Secretary do for the Department of Justice? Mr. Wittes intervened, copied the letter to the Prime Minister, the Justice Committee, many others, and he said, it is my duty to intervene. In other words, he's going to stop Boucher overspending. And Mr. Wittes said that it was his duty to do so and that it was John Boucher's duty to work within his budget. So we looked back and we thought, hold on a minute. So if Wittes has done that in justice, how come the permanent secretaries for education and health, have they sent warning letters? So we went to Jane Brady, the head of the civil service, and we said, look, in the public interest, could you clarify here? Could you just assure us that there's no inconsistency, that the permanent secretaries, if Wittes is doing it, that you're making sure that the permanent secretaries for health, the permanent secretaries for education, have also assured her that they will personally intervene. It couldn't be the duty of Hugh Wittes and not the duty of the other two permanent secretaries, could it? Well, guess what? Silence from Jane Brady. Silence from the civil service around this. And be in no doubt, the Education Minister, Paul Given, has said, and it was on Evening Extra, 15th of August, that his department is projected to overspend by hundreds of millions.
Schools will be provided with a new amount of funding allocated to each school to reflect the changes that came about through teacher salaries. But I also need to be very clear that the Department of Education, which I have outlined a number of months ago, is on a projected overspend of hundreds of millions of pounds. That is a pressure that is going to crystallise within an executive-wide level. And, you know, the cuts that would be required in order to bring that level of saving into the education system would devastate our system, and I'm not prepared to do that.
So Mark Brown's the Permanent Secretary for Education. Mark, are you going to protect our money? Have you written a warning letter to Paul Given telling him that that he must stay within his budget? Mark, Mr. Brown, have you copied that letter to different committees? Have you copied the letter to the Prime Minister? Now, of course, the context within which the letter was sent to the letter was sent to the Prime Minister was John Boucher fighting for more money with the Prime Minister, fighting to get it from the Prime Minister, and he's been told off for doing that. But this is a wider discussion this morning as to how many controls, how much control will there be on spending. So it's not just Paul, it's not just Paul Given, who has said that he's going to have to overspend in June. Here's what the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, said.
I recognise I must play my part alongside all executive colleagues to help deliver a hugely challenging budget, but for this to work, they and the members of this House also need to be willing to look at the very real challenges facing health and social care, and therefore the most vulnerable in our society also. Let me be clear, Deputy Speaker. Cuts with catastrophic impacts, not on my watch.
So what does that sound like? Peter May is the Permanent Secretary for the Department of Health. Mr. May, have you written to Mike Nesbitt warning him that you will personally intervene, as it is your duty to do so, if you follow what Mr. Wittes has said? Jason Coleraine's our first call of the day. Morning, Jason.
Morning, Stephen. So I've been speaking about this in the last couple of weeks in your show. And who is running the company at the moment? Is it the permanent secretaries, the LMAs, or the executive? Because nobody seems to know who makes these decisions.
Well, we're trying to understand where the consistency is. That if Boucher, the chief constable, is being warned that the permanent secretary will intervene, will the other permanent secretaries follow suit? And why?
I would say they would have to. If it's going to be across the board, you can't have one minister going off on his own and the other going off on his own. And where are they? They are in recess when they should not be at the minute. I don't care what, and I said this 2 weeks ago on your show. They should not be in recess. They're entitled to a holiday, yes. But at the minute, public services are in crisis.
We've been back and forward to the Department of Education. They essentially said to us that the Minister and the Permanent Secretary have discussed their respective responsibilities and are regularly reviewing the budget pressures faced by the department. We went back to them and said, what does that mean? Discussed their respective responsibilities. We've asked you, Department of Education, has the Permanent Secretary sent a letter to the Minister warning him about what he has said about overspending? So the department came back to us again and said, unlike the Chief Constable, ministers are not accounting officers. The minister fully understands the responsibilities the Permanent Secretary has as Departmental Accounting Officer and will continue to work with him and executive colleagues to address the budgetary pressures faced by the department. And then this coded message from the Department of Education. The Permanent Secretary will at all times fulfil the responsibilities he has as accounting officer under the requirements of Managing Public Money Northern Ireland. So is that, like policing, is that a Permanent Secretary warning the Education Minister that he will personally intervene? Permanent Secretary will at all times fulfil the responsibilities he has as accounting officer under the requirements of Managing Public Money Northern Ireland. It's certainly not as full on, is it, that language? Look at the difference of language between the Department of Education and the Justice Department. Naomi Long still has not clarified, she's the Justice Minister, whether she supported her Permanent Secretary copying that letter that we covered last week to all different people. She says she has supported Hugh Wittes sending it to the Chief Constable. Andrew McCormick was a former very senior civil servant. There was not much happened in Stormont without Andrew knowing about it. Morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, what's going on here? Look at how Boucher, John Boucher, the Chief Constable, received that letter, the warning given to him. If all of these people are accounting officers, have they all got to intervene? The permanent secretaries?
I'm sure a lot of that is actually happening, as the Department of Education statement implied, behind the scenes. The difference was that what happened with the PSNI was very public. John Boucher made it very public. So that makes it a bit different. I wrote letters in my time as an accounting officer, but you didn't know about them. They weren't public. The duties are being fulfilled. Both ministers and accounting officers have very, very clear responsibilities to live within budget. It's absolutely fundamental in our constitution. It goes back to the English Civil War. This is what the English Civil War is all about, was ministers or a king who refused to submit to parliamentary approval of expenditure. So it really is right at the heart of the constitution. And therefore, these things are worked out. There are procedures that need to be applied. I think the important point right now is actually, in a word, Paul Given used, projected. We don't know where things actually stand right now. What is going on at the moment is a lot of claims and bids for money, because there will be some money available. So everybody, all departments, are trying to make the maximise their chance of getting the best possible share of what's coming in the autumn. There'll be some money. It won't be enough. There'll be issues remaining. But what's going on at the moment is a lot of tactics being played.
But Andrew, if it is, you've said this morning, is there not a contradiction in what we, the public, are hearing from our elected representatives? In other words, these government ministers. They are saying that they may have to overspend, that there's a possibility they will overspend.
Yep.
You know, you could interpret it as there is a likelihood they will overspend. And you're saying fundamental to our system working is that they do not overspend. So will we come to a stage where the Permanent Secretary will block the minister spending, overspending, and can they do that?
Well, civil servants work for ministers. Civil servants work under the direction and control of ministers. The way in which authority can be applied over ministers is at two levels. One, from the executive, because it's the executive's responsibility to decide the budget, make the allocations, and it has the power to enforce that. That can be enforced. If a minister overspends, he is, by definition, in breach of the ministerial code. And the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister could introduce a motion to the Assembly to exclude that minister for breaching the ministerial code if they overspend. So that's one level of authority. The other level of authority is the Treasury. If the Executive collectively overspends, if Northern Ireland overspends its budget, then, as you've said, the Treasury can take back the money the next year. But there are other things they can do. They can tighten the degree of control over Northern Ireland, which is not what anybody wants. Devolution is all about local ministers taking decisions. The Treasury cannot and will not stand by and watch Northern Ireland overspend when they've got a major, major issue of fiscal credibility as a new government at the present time.
Well, we're going to be hearing, aren't we, Keir Starmer, after 10 this morning. Yep. We'll take some of that live, talk about how things are going to get worse before they get better, the pressure on public services. It's why, Andrew, we here at the Nolan Show think that money is the theme of the day, budget's the theme of the day. So can I just be clear, rather than consequences, if Mr. Given, and look, Paul is talking about spending money for education, Mike is talking about spending money for health, and there would be a lot of people supporting both of them doing it. They're not squandering money, are they?
Not at all. So these are very worthy causes.
So are you saying that there would be consequences after they spend it in terms of breaching the ministerial code, or could the First and Deputy First Minister step in and stop them overspending?
They could stop them in advance. If the clear statements after the next monitoring round, after things shake down a little bit in the next few weeks as the actual position emerges more clearly, if after that point ministers are saying, I can't deliver, I refuse to take the actions required, and this is where the Permanent Secretaries will be advising. They'll be saying, if you want to live within budget, here's what you need to do. Here are the things you need to change. That body of information will be in front of every minister in health, in justice, in education, across all the departments. The officials will have done their job in bringing that information out. If a minister says, no, I'm not going to do that, then the accounting officer can. I did this. This has actually happened in my watch. You write a letter saying, if you don't take these decisions, we're going to overspend, and you as minister then lose autonomy because Department of Finance would get involved. I copied my letter to Department of Finance in the expectation that they would say, right, we need to intervene here and stop a potential overspend.
How do they stop it?
They can come in and take more direct control of the spending decisions. All expenditure in our system is subject to Department of Finance approval. If it isn't approved by Department of Finance, it can't happen.
Like you said there, I just want to check, because I find this fascinating, because that's a Sinn Féin minister, Keith Archibald, in charge of the Department of Finance. So you said there, Andrew, that the Department of Finance could step in and stop overspending decisions. So does that mean Keith Archibald could essentially take control of the decisions within Department of Health, Department of Education? As controversial as that would be.
Well, it would only happen if that was the collective view of the executive. And that's a realpolitik point rather than a procedural point. The nominal power lies with the Department of Finance, but in that highly controversial context, it will automatically becomes a matter for the executive. So this requires both FM and DFM to play their part. You know, either they're saying this budget matters and we will enforce it in the ways we can, or if they're turning a blind eye and saying to implicitly to education and health, oh, carry on, keep on spending, we don't want to take responsibility for these cuts, then we only have the Treasury to intervene. Then the executive collectively gets the blame. This is a lot about placing the blame. That's what this is really all about.
And Mr. Willis, Hugh Willis, essentially he's done his job. You've got a chief constable saying out loud he's going to overspend, and Hugh Willis is saying, it's my duty to point out you've got to work within your budget. He's doing his job.
The public service jobs are complicated. So there's statutory obligations on officials to deliver public safety, to deliver in health quality of service. So yes, I mean, I'd be the first to emphasise the centrality of financial control, and that's a responsibility. But civil servants and ministers also have other duties that are really serious. That's where resolution of the tension between those things has to be a matter for the executive, and ultimately that's what flows from decisions in London. But we now have a fair share of UK public expenditure through the fiscal framework settled earlier this year, including the deal between Keith Archibald and the Chief Secretary of the Treasury before the election. That places us at a fair allocation. So appealing to London is not going to be that easily received.
And how, Andrew, when you've explained, and I understand now, that, look, if there is an overspend, that the First and Deputy First Minister, the Executive Office, could step in and could stop it. How could they not do that if both those parties, DUP and Sinn Féin, that form the Executive Office, they have both voted for the budget? So if they have supported the budget, how would it be anything but illogical for them not to step in and stop ministers who were stepping outside the budget that they had voted for?
Precisely. No, that's how the system should work. It's just a little bit too soon for that, because there will be some money available in the next couple of months as when you see what's actually being spent, when you've got to get to halfway through the year, if you've spent more than half your budget halfway through the year, then that's very strong evidence you're heading for overspend.
But
until we get to that point, we don't know precisely.
So why then, if you say it's a little bit too soon, why did Hugh Willis not wait and send his letter later?
That had both a public and a procedural aspect, and was so devolution is all about the responsibility lying with the devolved ministers, and every arm's length body in Northern Ireland. I worked very closely with the education boards in the 90s, with the health service more than 10 years ago. All of those bodies are part of a devolved system, and that means that the government in London has devolved the responsibility. They give us a block grant, and it's up to the executive how that's spent, and they will only listen to an appeal for extra from those who are responsible, that is First Minister, Deputy First Minister and Finance Minister. That's how the system works. And so there's a big difference there, that there was both a public aspect of that and a protocol aspect, as I've written in the letter.
You say you've written these type of letters before. Had you been writing it, and it's not clear whether the Naomi Long in her statement talked about supporting Hugh Whittis's sending of that letter to the Chief Constable, the correspondence, she said, to the Chief Constable. Of course, it was copied to many others. You say you've written similar letters. Would you have copied it as Hugh Whittis did?
No, the context was very different. The context was more like a kind of case you've been exploring in your questions to the department. So that it was internal. It was between a permanent secretary, as in me, and ministers. So that's more private. I would be very clear. I can't see how things can be working unless, as is actually implicit, clearly implicit in what Department of Education have told you, the facts are being explained to each minister. They're being told the run rate of expenditure, what's going on, what's the pattern of expenditure, what's the projected, Paul Given used the word projected, overspend, what could be done to change that, to bring expenditure within budget. All those things will be being worked out, and the crunch is coming, but is not yet.
David Graham with us this morning, former DUP Special Advisor. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Brendan Mulgrew, commentator, former SPAD, Special Advisor, in other words. Morning, Brendan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So, Brendan, let's start with you. Essentially, we've heard it many times in the news, these government ministers, again, I say they're trying to spend money for people's education, for people's health, and many people will support them. But it kind of went into the news cycle and went out again. And I didn't hear much discussion about, well, hold on a minute, will the system try to stop them? And that's what we're doing this morning. We're probing what's likely to happen here, Brendan.
Yeah, and I mean, Andrew has very helpfully set out the technical and legal points around all of this, Stephen. And it's interesting when you listen back, especially to what Paul Given said and the words that he used. I would have thought, if I was inside politics still looking at what he was saying, he was positioning himself ahead of any monitoring round or any availability of future funds. He talked about unpalatable or cuts that couldn't be stood over. That was as much him saying to his executive colleagues, hey, when we do get extra money, I'm going to need a big chunk of that. And I think Mike Nesmith is saying the same thing in slightly different language, but he's setting out his stall to say, I'm going to need a big slice of any future money. The difference with what happened last week with John Boucher, I think, to be honest, I think politics met procedure and ended up in a letter which was, in my view, designed to be made public by being copied to so many people.
Well, no, we don't know that. We do not know
We don't know that, and but it's hard to copy that. A letter. It's hard, Stephen, to copy a letter to that many people and imagine for a moment that it's going to stay private. And that was to do with the very sort of personality of John Boucher, I think, and him taking advantage of the opportunity to raise the points he wanted to make with the Prime Minister. A lot of people on the outside would say, well, what did he do wrong? He's making the case for extra funds for the PSNI. And there is a slight difference here too, because part, even though it's a very small part of the PSNI budget, does come directly from the UK government.
But the story that I'm trying to focus on this morning, Brendan, is that Hugh Whittis has said it is his duty to intervene. In other words, to stop Boucher overspending. Well, if you follow that logic and it is the duty of other permanent secretaries to intervene and stop, then I'm trying to focus this morning on what that will mean this year for our public services. So what happens if actually, as Andreas explained to us, the permanent secretary gives the warning, the executive office, first and deputy first minister, then step in and tell education, you ain't spending that money. If they step in and tell Boucher, you are not overspending, how does that manifest itself on the streets? That's the story.
Yeah, John Boucher, in the case of the PSNI, would have to decide if he can live within his budget and what kind of cuts would need to be made in order for him to do so. And he may then go back to the permanent secretary and the policing board, of course, in his case, and set out all of that. And it might just be so unpalatable that it forces the issue around finding extra funds from within the Northern Ireland Executive or trying to secure extra funds from UK government. But as Andrew said, people are looking ahead here to what might happen. I mean, Hugh Willis's letter was as much to do with the process of John Boucher going to the Prime Minister as it was any projected announcement.
David?
Well, I think, Stephen, I think, and Brendan, I agree there with almost everything you've said. I think that the challenge that we've got here is obviously Andrew McCormick was on, or he may still be on, saying that he's written letters like that before. I think that the difficulty is, my experience, certainly when Stormont was down, that permanent secretaries took the position of, look, nothing to do with us, Gov. We are simply here kind of, you know, keeping the lights on until we get a minister in place. Now, we all know that from 2017, Stormont has been down more than it has been up. And I think the issue here is that, you know, basically permanent secretaries are not prepared to make any decisions without political cover. But then, ironically, a permanent secretary here is saying, by the way, if you make certain decisions, I need to remind you that you are the chief accounting officer. So it's a confusing message.
No, Willis said that he trumped him as accounting officer and it was his duty to intervene. That's what
yes,
Willis told
sorry,
the
yes.
chief constable.
Stephen, Mr. sorry, you're entirely right that Hugh Willis did that. And essentially, as you say, trumped everyone else and therefore certainly outlined that he had powers available to make certain decisions. And I think the other issue that we've got here is that this is highlighting Stormont. I don't want to come on every time in your show and say the dysfunctionality, but essentially we have got ministers here, as Brendan said, that are basically setting their stall out for the next monitoring round to say, I need X, and if I don't get X, we are going to overspend. And, you know, at the end of the day, that really won't do ministers any harm with the public, because you're dealing with people's lives when it comes to health and Mike Nesbitt. You're dealing with children's future and education when it comes to Paul Given. And I think really, and something that hasn't been mentioned, is fundamentally John Boucher here is being put in his place because he's saying we have got policemen and policewomen risking their lives on a daily basis with the terrorist threat, with other issues. And essentially, I can't stand over allowing this to continue. So this is not straightforward, Stephen. There's, as Brendan said, there's a political aspect to this, and there's a process aspect to this.
But Andy McCormick, if you were still in Stormont watching, it's clear that Boucher's a fighter, isn't it? Like it's clear that he's not shy, and he is saying out loud. He's talking out loud about some of his officers taking their own lives and the potential for more of that if they're put under so much pressure. So, Andrew, what will Stormont, in your view, do about John Boucher's style? And at the end of the day, will he get the money?
Well, I think there's a whole range of issues that are comparably bad. And the issue is the need for the executive collectively to face up to financial responsibilities. They can no longer say they haven't got a fair share of UK public expenditure. They're imposing through the budget. The budget does require deep cuts in health, education and justice that are really, really difficult. And either the executive sees that through and says, well, we know that, we see it through, and all those things happen, or they find an alternative way, and there are several things they can do. They could raise more revenue. Is that what I've said before many times? Is that really worse from the point of view of the Northern Ireland public than the consequences of inadequate public services? That's the choice for the public. That they keep electing people who say no more rates, and then they complain that the services aren't good enough. That's a matter for how electoral politics works, and it's not fully functional in our context. They need to make a case to the Treasury, but they need to get into a place where they've got credibility, and that means looking hard at the conditions that were imposed when the financial package was agreed earlier this year. Time and time again, the Treasury has rolled over or been required to roll over by Number 10 or the NIO for the sake of Northern Ireland. We have at the moment a new Labour government which is establishing its financial credibility. It's done some hard things already on winter fuel payments, on two-child benefit. They can't afford to lose their credibility by saying, oh, we'll turn a blind eye to Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland overspends, that's all right, we don't mind. That will be raised with them by the Scottish government, who are facing a range of serious financial decisions. Wales, those administrations are taking hard decisions. So the executive needs to take the hard decisions.
The executive still haven't made a decision about winter fuel payments, for example. They haven't decided, have they?
I don't know that, but if there's a question of what powers do they have, can they top, could they find a way to top up? If they decide to do that, then they're having to find more money from a budget that's already overstretched. So it's a real serious dilemma, and they need to face up to these issues and, you know, work it out and get to a place of credibility with the Treasury in London.
Do you think it lacks credibility at the moment?
Yes, I nearly choked there. look at all that's happened.
Why does Stormont lack credibility with the Treasury? Why?
Because they keep asking for money, and Treasury says, "Well, can you make some contribution? The 100 million that was put into the package of the extra revenue." That's a very small contribution to the package. We want you to pay everything and we won't pay anything. That's not exactly a compelling negotiating strategy.
Okay. Andrew, David, Brendan, thank you very much indeed. 03030805555. Here comes the news from the BBC. Wynne and Warren Point. Good morning, Wynne.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, Northern Ireland at the moment is that far down the track. I honestly don't think it'll ever be fixed because it's just getting worse. And the biggest problem is Stormont has no credibility. Because even the simple task when they're asked, did they make a pledge by the other parties not to walk out, they wouldn't do it. They've no credibility anywhere because they've been out 5 years in the last 10. And no matter what department you're going for, every one of them is broke. And the cash cow that they blamed in the Tory party, to blame the Conservatives saying, oh, it's the Conservatives' fault. Labour is not going to be an cash cow for them because basically they will not take responsibility for anything. And the people of Northern Ireland got to understand, they walked out for 5 years and not one of them suffered.
But the responsibility, well, they had their pay cut, didn't they? But the responsibility...
Oh, Stephen, it takes them 2 years to get a pay cut. It takes them 3 years to make a decision. I can sit every day and ask people what they're worried about, and they're saying is, where's their children on their list? Where's their mothers on their list?
So what do you want them to do? Do you want
them to... I want them all to go home and get somebody else that actually can do a job, because none of them are actually capable of doing a job.
Well, that's just not true.
It is true, Stephen. It takes them 3 years to do anything. It's all right, there's all right, these politicians sit up there, the BBC presenters sit up there, there's people day to day in a daily situation, sitting lining up, they're waiting for their children to go into the hospital, their mothers waiting cancer treatment, their parents waiting for treatment.
And we are reflecting those issues every single day.
Yes, but the problem is they don't change their issues because they don't need them, it's not their families. They don't care. You have 95 people up there that take money, and about 45 of them don't give one monkeys if we all die in the morning as long as the British government keeps throwing out money to them. It's a cash cow, the biggest ATM machine in the country. That's all it is to them. And we suffer the price, and it doesn't matter what side of the community you're from. Why does it take them so long to build houses in the Nunez community? Because it suits them.
What do you want them to do?
Go home and let somebody else run it, because they couldn't run a bath.
But how would you run it? What would you do? Would you raise more revenue from the public at this time when people are stretched?
But I would hit the rich. I wouldn't care if I got £1 of 1 millionaire. It's £1 more than I have. Get rid of the cap on anybody's got a house over £500,000. Make them pay his rate of value. People say it's not an awful lot. It's more than I have. If it helps the schools with assistance.
It would not pay for the shortfall that Northern Ireland has in its finances.
No, but if they make a decision that they won't walk out, the British government might turn around and say, right, there's a guarantee. They've got to make it work. This is also responsible for the people of Northern Ireland, and it doesn't matter what side of the community. You have to hold them account. You can't moan about
it. What do you think we're doing?
Yes, but it's the people who go out and vote, Stephen, have to hold them for account. You run every program every day. It's the same thing. But the people are only, there's only a small amount complaining.
Well, look, what we're doing as a program this morning, rather than waiting until it's happened, what we're doing is discussing how this might roll out, that we could get to a stage that if these ministers overspend, and many of the public might support them overspending, it's health, it's education, it's children in school, it's people on waiting lists, and that's what Nesbitt and Given are looking after. But what we're trying to have a discussion about, not on the day it's happening, but beforehand, is how does the system respond? And Andrew McCormick explaining to his way in that how the system could respond, how the system has the power to understand, is that the Executive Office, the First and Deputy First Minister, who have voted for this budget, could say stop. They could stop them overspending.
Yes.
Would you want them to do that? Because if they don't stop them overspending, this is why this is such an important story. You've got to find that money in the next year. Or you've got to offset it against something.
Yes, but my honest opinion, Stephen, and I don't know if this will happen or not, the other parties, when they called them in, they asked the DUP and the Sinn Féin parties to make a decision that they would never walk out. It would be like a guarantee. I would say if they sit down in the morning and when the parties asked them, will you not walk out again? They've been out, in five, out of the last 10, they've been out 5 and they'll get paid for it. But my question is, that is a guarantee to the British government that will put money. At the minute, they've no guarantee that they won't go out tomorrow.
I just want to bring you all also, look, not just the statement from the Department of Health, but really interestingly, we got then a line from a special advisor within the Department of Health as well. The Department of Health said to us when we were asking these questions about whether the Permanent Secretary has a duty to intervene, just like Hugh Wittes has with the Chief Constable, Department of Health said the situation regarding the 24-25 budget was set out by the Health Minister in a statement to the Assembly last month. I can inform members that intensive work continues to secure greater efficiency and productivity across the health and social care system. I am currently assessing the latest position regarding my department's budgetary shortfall. This statement must be on behalf of Mike Nesbitt, taking on board trust saving plans, the June monitoring round allocation and the wider UK public expenditure context. I fully accept, says Mike Nesbitt, the requirement for significant savings, but I again make clear there are lines I will not cross as minister. He said, my predecessor was clear that the executive's budget was unmanageable when voting against it. The executive now needs to take an overall look at the position and agree the next steps. There are lines, he says, that I will not cross as minister. Does that mean Mike Nesbitt is going to overspend if he deems he has to? Lines I will not cross. And will the permanent secretary step in? That's a guy called Peter May, isn't it, at the Department of Health. Will Peter May, the Permanent Secretary, step in and send a warning letter to Nesbitt? Will he do that? Has he already done it? We've asked the civil service. They won't tell us. But then this extra line from a special advisor. So we got that statement from the Department of Health. Look at this extra line that the Nolan Show then got from a special advisor within the Department of Health. It reads as follows. I have impressed upon the Finance Minister and the head of the civil service, this is a special advisor, my view that the executive should examine collectively the overall strains in the budget. As they affect individual departments, I understand that argument has been accepted. So this is from a special advisor on behalf of Mike Nesbitt. Let me read this again. I've impressed upon the Finance Minister and the Head of Civil Service my view the Executive should examine collectively the overall strains in the budget as they affect individual departments. I understand that argument has been accepted. So that's Nesbitt saying that the Finance Minister and the Head of the Civil Service are looking at the health budget. That's what he's saying there. That's interesting in itself. Wayne, thank you very much. Morning to you. We promise we'll stay across all of this. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call. just my brain's gone back there to Nesbitt saying, I understand that argument has been accepted. That means the head of the civil service is looking, and the finance minister is looking at more money, contemplating, not deciding, but they are looking at more money for health. That's what Nesbitt's saying within that statement. Okay, we'll stay across it for you. Prime Minister due to speak at 10 o'clock this morning. Keir Starmer is expected to say things will get worse rather than better. Does that mean more tax rises? We'll take some of that speech live after 10 today. What about these roadworks then? Close to Belfast city centre. Seems almost every road as roadworks are some sort of lane closure or diversion. Wesley Johnson, commentator at Northern Ireland Roads and Motorways. Morning to you, Wesley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Wesley. And Robert, the taxi driver. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Wesley.
How's it going down with taxi drivers, Robert?
Stephen, have you been caught in this traffic congestion yourself?
Yes.
Well, give us your experience and then I'll give you mine as many taxi drivers. Go ahead, Stephen. What's your experience?
I was driving down the Ormo Road this morning. A lot of the Ormo Road is blocked off, right? The lane is restricted on the Ormo Road, certainly get up the Ormo Road. Not one worker on it. And I'm told yesterday, not one worker was a bank holiday yesterday. So they've taken a lane out of the Ormo Road. They're definitely working on it. I've seen them on it. But I'm told there were very few people on it yesterday. And today, not one. Not one worker at 8 o'clock this morning on that Ormo Road stretch. That's what I've experienced.
Yeah. And have you been in Great Victoria Street, Stephen, down towards the Europa Hotel?
No.
Oh, you want to see that, Stephen? It's what you call the Dynamo effect. The roadworks in the Ormo Road and the roadworks at Great Victoria Street, Upper House, Europa Hotel junction there, there's no left turn into the Gravener Road where traffic would try to make it onto the motorway. So they're forced to go into Donegal Square East, you know, where you used to go there at Ents. It forces all the traffic down there. And what happens as well, coming up Hard Street, you come up Hard Street, you can't turn left into Great Victoria Street now. So it's forcing all the traffic up into the Gravener Road. The one lane where the Fitzwilliam Hotel there is, that's blocked. So there's only the one lane. Well, and traffic's turning right to go into Donegal Square East. It's so complicated, this, Stephen. And if you come down Lennon Hall Street, down the side of the BBC, to go out into Donegal Square South, which is at the side of the City Hall, what happens is a yellow box there, and you're sitting there waiting on the lights change. And when the lights change in Lennon Hall Street, for you to go out into Donegal Square South, I'm not getting it any. Coming up that bus lane, a bus will come out and the bus can go no further. So he's jammed in the yellow box. And also cars. So you're sitting at a green light and you can't go anywhere. You know, and then the lights change to go red. So you haven't moved.
How bad is it at the moment?
The point I'm making here, Stephen, is the Dynamo effect. What happens in them scenarios, the whole town becomes a total car park. If you're coming down University Road to go into Bradbury Place, or if you're coming down Lisburn Road to go into Bradbury Place, it's bumper to bumper. And it's caused so many problems out there. It's unbelievable. Not only for taxi drivers, anybody travelling in a vehicle.
The Department of Infrastructure is saying there are a number of projects currently underway across Belfast, most notably the construction of Grand Central Station, which when completed will transform things, and so it goes on. And they're saying they closely monitor the movement of traffic across the city. Wesley Johnson, when I go to America, which is quite frequent, they work overnight. You see all these, if we're travelling from one city to another or whatever, you see them out working overnight. Why do these people not do it here?
There are some works that are carried out overnight in Northern Ireland, but I think by and large, there's a couple of different reasons for that. One is that, you know, there are certain areas like the Ormo Road where working overnight would be very, very disruptive because there's people living along there. When you get to the city centre, I mean, these are works that involve deep excavation. So even working overnight, it might reduce the duration of it a bit, but it wouldn't prevent the closure from happening. And I'm sure there's an element too also that it, you know, it's expensive to employ people overnight.
But so the same people who are living there overnight are living there during the day. Mm-hmm. How long's the scheme is expected? What are they saying here? They've got all these different phases for these roadworks. Phoenix mm-hmm. Energy are carrying out essential planned works in their network in Belfast City Centre. The developer-led junction improvement scheme in the A24 Sainfield Knock Bracken Road will begin on the 6th of August. The scheme's expected to last 60 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And there's others too. There's the Phoenix Works that started today, I think it was, on the Upper Newton Arch Road at Dundonald. And there's another junction improvement on the A23 Cumber Road as well. And we've got resurfacing on the King's Road. So yes, there's an awful lot of things happening at once. One of the problems we have is that our roads are not just conduits for traffic, they're also conduits for utilities, you know, because, you know, for obvious reasons, it's not possible to dig them up if they go under people's buildings. So that means that if you want to upgrade, say, the gas system, which is what we're doing at the minute, it has to be done in the roads. You know, if you have a road that has a bus lane, it's possibly not as disruptive as it would have been before the bus lanes, because you can shift all the traffic into the bus lane. But still, you know, in the city centre, there is so much traffic, it's just not possible to do work like this without creating some congestion.
Should they be doing it all at once?
Some of these projects, they're taking, you know, 18 months maybe, or 9 months, depending on the project. Doing it all at once would involve, you know, closing the entire road probably for a period of several weeks.
But my point, Wesley, sorry, is that they are, by their own admission, and we can see it on the ground, they are doing a whole number of different projects at once.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the right way to approach this, or should they have done one project and then another and then another?
If you look at the Phoenix Gas project, for example, 9 months in South Belfast, another 9 months, you would be talking a year and a half to get it all done if you spaced them out. If the one at Grand Central Station, you know, that needs to be done before the station can open. So, I mean, yes, you could space them out. It would just mean that everything that they're being built for would get pushed into the future. And to be honest, there probably is not enough happening, because we're underinvesting in road maintenance, and you know, there's a lot of roadworks that would be happening if we had more money to spend on road maintenance, which we're not spending. You know, and we're seeing that every time you drive over a pothole, you're seeing the impact of that.
Should bus lanes, where there are works undergoing and one lane is closed off, should they relax the bus lanes to help the flow of traffic?
Yes, they should. And I think that is what is happening on the Upper Newton Arch Road. I was just through it there about half an hour ago, and they're diverting everyone onto the bus lane there to get past the congestion. So that's why I say, you know, the fact that the bus lane exists makes some of these problems not as bad as they would have been, you know, 10, 20 years ago when there was no bus lane and you were trying to squeeze two lanes of traffic into one. Now you're trying to squeeze a busy traffic lane into a lane that has a lot of gaps in it, because it's just buses, motorcyclists, you know, certain taxis, cyclists using it, so there's more space.
Joe's in Carrie Duff. Morning, Joe.
I just want to make the point that when the bus lanes are in operation, basically what happens, it comes 9:30 and they're no longer in operation, people just double park on the Armour Road the whole way down there, which effectively means you've still got, in a roundabout way, a bus lane. And also, when you get down as far as the Hatfield Bar, on the left-hand side, just facing the Hatfield Bar...
I know it. There's a sweet shop beside it. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, well, there's a break in the yellow lines just opposite the Hatfield Bar, and people park there, and you're coming down at 9:30 in the morning.
That's right.
And basically, you're all forced back out on the outside lane.
That's right.
And it's the same if you come out of University Street to turn right. There's traffic coming up the Armour Road. You go to turn right, and there's cars parked on the left-hand side. It becomes a bottleneck, and the place is absolutely mayhem.
So why don't they continue the line right down the road?
Exactly.
You're dead right. I've seen this. When I'm driving into work, there's a line down the road, then it just stops for a wee while. Then it starts
again. There may be one or two cars parked on the road. So effectively, that bus lane is back in operation, because everyone is forced out in the outside lane. It causes chaos around that whole junction.
Have you experienced the roadworks yet?
Oh, dreadful. Absolutely. I'm coming down from Carrie Duff now, and the roadworks are up on the Sainfield Road now are horrendous. Trying to get up and down past Knock Bracken Hill Curve, Puttysburn, Old Puttysburn. It's just horrendous. At the spur of the day that they initiate the what do you call it, that purple bus, was it again? The glider up in the carried off, because everybody forced out on the one lane coming down the St. Louis Road, just a bit chaotic.
I'll tell you what, this disruption that you're experiencing on the roads because of the roads work, roadworks, Joe, this is before the schools get back.
I know.
So the schools get back tomorrow. What is it going to be like next week?
Goodness knows. We absolutely horrendous. Everyone will be taking their back roads to try and get down into the town. Absolutely horrendous. I honestly don't think these things are very well thought out. I really don't.
Is that fair, Wesley?
It comes back to the situation of you can't do these things without creating the disruption, you know, at the end of the day. So you either don't do them at all, or you create some disruption. And I think as far as possible, they're timed for school holidays, but school holidays only last 9 weeks, you know, and some of these projects take a year or more. So, you know, there's a limit to what can be done with that. You know, what you're saying about enforcement on the, you know, on the Omagh Road is right. I mean, we're very relaxed about parking and double parking. We're not very good at enforcement, and there probably is more we could do, you know, in terms of double yellow lines and enforcement of clearways and that sort of thing.
Tell you what, we're not very relaxed if you're going shopping and you park your car. It's that main route into the city centre down that Omagh Road. Joe's on the money. He's dead right. There's one, you often, and by the way, Joe, it's sometimes the same car sitting there day in, day out, which basically takes up the whole lane. You couldn't make it up. Robert and Derry.
It may be the case that they live there. I don't know, but it's certainly the case that they've caused chaos in the park.
Morning, Robert. Hey, Robert and Derry, good morning. We'll try it a different way. Robert in Londonderry, good morning. He's still not there.
Okay. Hello, there's a Robert in Belfast. Oh, I'm still here.
No, I know you are. What more do you want to say?
Well, Stephen, you know, it's been badly advertised. Why did the relevant people not advertise to these people that the roadworks were starting for so many weeks? Nobody has said when these roadworks finished. There was no advertisement to advise people to avoid Belfast because of the roadworks. Do you know what I mean? And that there should have been widely across media networks to let the general public know that if it wasn't really necessary, make all alternatives to get into the city centre, like using public transport.
Let's see if we can squeeze the other Robert in. Good morning, Robert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Stephen. This is only a thought. I don't know whether it would be feasible or not. But you see, if BT was going to dig a track down the road, why doesn't they mention to all the oil utilities and say, listen, we're going to dig a track down here. Do you just need BT line or do you need that line? And put them all on at the one time.
I want to know, because I don't know, when these schools come back, and that's from tomorrow, is it? Do I have to get up early in the morning to get in here?
I don't know, that could be a problem, like getting me up in the morning.
I know. Am I going to have to get up earlier? I genuinely need to know before tomorrow morning, what's it likely to be when these schools come back?
If I had anything to do with it, I would send you an email maybe a couple of hours in advance and get you up early.
Thank you, Robert. Here comes the news at 10. So the Prime Minister has just started speaking. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to talk about how dire the financial situation of the country is in. Let's dip into this and have a listen live.
Those serving our community and our country every day. I promised that we would get a grip on the problems that we face and that we would be judged by our actions, not by our words. I said before the election, and I say it again really clearly today, growth, and frankly by that I do mean wealth creation, is the number one priority of this Labour government. And that's why in our first few weeks we've set up the National Wealth Fund, because we want every person and every community to benefit. It's why we've unlocked planning decisions, because we're going to build 1.5 million new homes. It's why we set up Great British Energy to create good jobs and cut people's bills. And it's why we ended the national strikes that have crippled our country for years. Because I defy anyone to tell me that you can grow the economy when people can't get to work because the transport system is broken, or can't return to work because they're stuck on an NHS waiting list. We've done more in 7 weeks than the last government did in 7 years. And these are just the first steps towards the change that people voted for, the change that I'm determined to deliver. But before the election, I also gave a warning. I said change would not happen overnight. When there's a deep rot at the heart of a structure, you can't just cover it up. You can't just tinker or rely on quick fixes. You have to overhaul the entire thing. Tackle it at root, even if it's harder work and takes more time. Because otherwise, what happens? The rot returns in all the same places, and it spreads worse than before. You know that. I know that. And that's why this project has always been about fixing the foundations of our country. But I have to be honest with you. Things are worse than we ever imagined. In the first few weeks, we discovered a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. And before anyone says, oh, this is just performative or playing politics, let's remember the OBR did not know about it. They wrote a letter setting that out. And they didn't know because the last government hid it. And even last Wednesday, we found out that thanks to the last government's recklessness, we borrowed almost £5 billion more than the OBR expected in the last 3 months alone. That's not performative, that's fact. But as well as the things that we've discovered, we've also seen shocking scenes across the nation. A mindless minority of thugs who thought that they could get away with causing chaos, smashing up communities and terrifying minorities, vandalising and destroying people's property, even trying to set fire to a building with human beings inside it. And as if that wasn't despicable enough, people displaying swastika tattoos, shouting racist slurs on our streets, Nazi salutes at the cenotaph. The cenotaph, the very place we honour those who gave their lives for this country, desecrating their memory under the pretense, and it is a pretense, of legitimate protest. Now they're learning that crime has consequences, that I won't tolerate a breakdown in law and order under any circumstances, and I will not listen to those who exploit grieving families and disrespect local communities. But these riots didn't happen in a vacuum. They exposed the state of our country, revealed a deeply unhealthy society, the cracks in our foundations laid bare, weakened by a decade of division and decline, infected by a spiral of populism which fed off cycles of failure of the last government. Every time they faced a difficult problem, they failed to be honest. They offered the snake oil of populism, which led to more failure, round and round and round, stuck in the rut of the politics of performance. I saw the beginning of that downward spiral firsthand back in 2011, when riots ripped through London and across the country. I was then Director of Public Prosecutions. And when I think back to that time, I see just how far we have fallen. Because responding to those riots was hard. Of course it was. But dealing with the riots this summer was much harder. Back in 2011, I didn't doubt that the courts could do what they needed to do. This time, to be honest with you, I genuinely didn't know. Let me tell you this, every day of that disorder, literally every day, we had to check the precise number of prison places and where those places were to make sure that we could arrest, charge and prosecute people quickly. Not having enough prison places is about as fundamental a failure as you can get. And those people throwing rocks, torching cars, making threats, they didn't just know the system was broken. They were betting on it, gaming it. They thought, they'll never arrest me. And if they do, I won't be prosecuted. And if I am, I won't get much of a sentence. They saw the cracks in our society after 14 years of failure, and they exploited them. That's what we've inherited. Not just an economic black hole, a societal black hole. And that's why we have to take action and do things differently. And part of that is being honest with people about the choices that we face, how tough this will be. And frankly, things will get worse before they get better. I didn't want to release prisoners early. I was chief prosecutor for 5 years. It goes against the grain of everything I've ever done. But to be blunt, if we hadn't taken that difficult decision immediately, we wouldn't have been able to respond to the riots as we did. And if we don't take tough action across the board, we won't be able to fix the foundations of the country as we need. I didn't want to means test the winter fuel payment, but it was a choice that we had to make, a choice to protect the most vulnerable pensioners while doing what is necessary to repair the public finances. Because pensioners also rely on a functioning NHS, good public transport, strong national infrastructure. They want their children to be able to buy homes. They want their grandchildren to get a good education. So we have made that difficult decision to mend the public finances so everyone benefits in the long term, including pensioners. Now, that is a difficult trade-off, and there will be more to come. I won't shy away from making unpopular decisions now if it's the right thing for the country in the long term. That's what a government of service means. This shouldn't be a country where people fear walking down their street, their TVs showing cars and buildings being set on fire. This shouldn't be a country where the Prime Minister can't guarantee prison places. This shouldn't be a country where people are paying thousands more on their mortgages or waiting months for hospital appointments they desperately need, where our waters are filled with sewage, where parents worry that their kids won't get the opportunities that they did, where nothing seems to work anymore. So when I talk about the inheritance the last government left us, the £22 billion black hole in our finances, that isn't about a line on a graph. That's about people's lives, your lives. And the Tories are still not being honest. They know their recklessness cost them the election, but they won't accept the cost that they've inflicted on the country. And they won't apologise for what they've cost you. They're just still thinking about themselves. Now, this government won't always be perfect. But I promise you this. You will be at the heart of it, in the forefront of our minds, at the centre of everything that we do. And that's why I wanted to invite you here today, to show that decent, hard-working people who make up the backbone of this country belong here. This is a government for you. A garden and a building that were once used for lockdown parties. Remember the pictures just over there of the wine and the food? Well, this garden and this building are now back in your service. It's not just that the last government relied on easy gimmicks and bad ideas. Those things happened precisely because the government itself lost its focus on the hopes and ambitions of working people. During those recent riots, I made huge asks of the police and of the criminal justice system. People already stretched to the limit. They knew I was making big asks of them. And I'm not going to apologise for it. But let me tell you this. They delivered. They deserve our gratitude. And that's why I went to Southport, to Lambeth, to Belfast, to thank them personally, to shake the hands of the first responders who rose up to the ask I was making of them. They deserve a government that trusts them, supports them, and works with them. That is the sort of government that we will be. One that works with people, not does things to them. One that believes in hard graft, not gimmicks. Honest about the challenges we face and working tirelessly to fix them. And that is how we will always work. Now, next week, Parliament returns. The business of politics will resume. But it won't be business as usual, because we can't go on like this anymore. Things will have to be done differently. We will do the hard work to root out 14 years of rot, reverse a decade of decline, and fix the foundations. Between now and Christmas, we will carry on as we've started. Action, not words. We will introduce legislation and take decisions to protect taxpayers' money, to take on the blockers by accelerating planning to build homes and boost growth. We will forward this autumn to harness the full potential of AI for growth and for the public good. We'll bring rail service into public ownership, putting passengers first, the biggest levelling up of workers' rights in a generation, to give people security, dignity and respect at work. And Great British Energy will be owned by the taxpayer, making money for the taxpayer, producing clean energy and creating good jobs. That is our focus for the rest of the year. But I will be honest with you, there is a budget coming in October, and it's going to be painful. We have no other choice given the situation that we're in. Those with the broadest shoulders should bear the heavier burden. And that's why we're cracking down on non-doms. Those who made the mess should have to do their bit to clean it up. And that's why we're strengthening the powers of the water regulator and backing tough fines on the water companies that have let sewage flood our rivers, lakes and seas. But just as when I responded to the riots, I'll have to turn to the country and make big asks of you as well. To accept short-term pain for long-term good. The difficult trade-off for the genuine solution. And I know that after all that you have been through, that is a really big ask and really difficult to hear. That is not the position we should be in. It's not the position I want to be in. But we have to end the politics of the easy answer that solves nothing. But I also know that we can get through this together. Because the riots didn't just betray the sickness. They also revealed the cure, found not in the cynical conflict of populism, but in the coming together of a country. The people who got together the morning after, all around the country, with their brooms, their shovels, their trowels, and cleared up their community. They reminded us who we really are. I felt real pride in those people who cleaned up our streets, rebuilt the walls, repaired the damage. And I couldn't help thinking about the obvious parallels.
Well, that's the because Prime imagine Minister the pride who is speaking in front of a podium, fixing the foundations is written on it. Anne Watt is director of the think tank Pivotal. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, there you have it. It was predicted in the press. The Prime Minister saying a budget coming in October, it's going to be painful. My goodness, that's going to shock some people. It was predicted, but he said it out loud. What's going to be painful about it, Anne? Who's he going to hit?
Yes, I think if we listen to Rachel Reeves at the end of July when she talked about the $22 billion gap in the public, she's the Chancellor. Yeah, so she talked about this big gap in public finances that they discovered since they came in, and listening to that, you could see where things were going in terms of what might happen in future budgets on taxation or on public spending. If there's a $22 billion gap, that's got to be closed one way or the other, either through higher taxes, lower spending, or increased borrowing. So that's just the way the public finances work. So it feels today like we've had the 8 weeks of a honeymoon period since Labour got elected, and now it's getting down to the bad news or the painful news of difficult times ahead. And very much the Prime Minister there was emphasising this is because of what we've inherited from the previous government. So he's turning the blame on them in terms of the public finances.
He is, and obviously what the Tories are saying, what the Conservative Party is saying, they are saying that this is Keir Starmer making this up, essentially, making this £22 billion black hole that he talks about up in order to do things that he promised he would not do before he was voted in. He is just in 8 weeks. In the context of what we were talking about here in Northern Ireland at the top of the Nolan Show at 9 o'clock, we were talking about decisions that the executive haven't made about making the budget stack up. There you have the British Prime Minister saying, I didn't want to means test winter fuel payments, but I had no choice. It wasn't a popular decision, but it's the decision I had to make. I'll remind you, Stormont haven't made that decision. So in the context of this British Prime Minister saying there's a lot of bad stuff to come here, painful stuff to come, Stormont just aren't making some of the decisions. And that will focus the discussion on that. John in Portrush. Morning, John.
The Tories are on the attack again, Stephen.
The Tories?
The Tories, yes. They're attacking Keir Starmer for things that he's doing now. He has no option to do those things because they filled their pockets with things they shouldn't have been doing.
Well, why didn't he tell us this before he was elected?
They made profit out of vaccines, and they made profit out of PPE, and it's lying. The PPE's lying in warehouses, rotting. They cost the government, and they took us down the road, down the lane, and laughed at us for 14 years. The government have always done, they've left a hole in the treasury when they leave the office.
So what the Prime Minister just said there is that they will bring in legislation to protect taxpayers' money. What does that mean? He talked about going after non-doms, described them as those with the broadest shoulders.
I agree.
He said there's a big ask for everybody in the country, short-term pain for long-term good. Let me come back to Anne Watt, Director of Pivotal. Is this likely, Anne, to only affect the rich, given the promises that the Prime Minister made before he was elected? In other words, income tax would not go up, VAT would not go up, or is this likely to affect us all?
Well, I think he clearly said that the people with the broadest shoulders would have to bear more, and he pointed then, I assume, to people with the highest income, and possibly people who are avoiding taxes at the minute, and he's taking a line where he's being very tough on them. But he did then say, as well as that, there would be short-term pain for the long-term good, and implying that that's for everyone. So it may be that he is thinking about some change to taxation that would affect people on more average incomes, ordinary incomes. That would be a complete reversal from what Labour said in their manifesto. I mean, they were very, very clear that they weren't raising any of the main taxes, but maybe he's teeing himself up for that, for some change there, simply because he's discovered the numbers are a lot worse than what they had thought. So I think we have to wait and see.
We'll find out about that. The budget is in October, isn't it? When the Prime Minister talked about that budget in October, he said, quote, it's going to be painful.
Yeah, and I think it's important, as you were saying a few minutes ago, Northern Ireland has its own version of public spending problems, which are much worse than the rest of the UK. So anything that the Prime Minister is saying about the whole of the UK's public finances is a whole lot worse here. You know, we've had overspends in the last 2 years. We've had projected overspends this year that you've been talking about. We're raising less revenue locally. So if things are bad for the UK as a whole, they're even worse for Northern Ireland. And I think important as well, Prime Minister there was very much emphasising we need to not shy away from unpopular decisions. We need to do the right thing. We need to make choices, even if they're not popular. And our politicians here need to listen to that as well and think about if they're making those decisions.
And I'm asking Michelle O'Neill, Emma Little-Pengelly, the first and deputy first minister of this place. There's the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom standing in the Rose Garden. He's not making himself popular today, and he is laying out to the people of the UK what is going to be, his words, painful decisions. Where is Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly telling us in Northern Ireland what our outlook is likely to be, how we're going to make things add up? Like, we led the show today asking about the mechanisms. Where are the politicians and what talking to us about what the future is for Northern Ireland over the short term?
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. And this comes back to something you and I have talked about before, and you've talked about a lot in your programme, which is the lack of a programme for government at present. So we don't know. We don't know what our politicians are planning to do at the minute. We don't know how they're planning to improve services, either in the short term or in the longer term. We haven't seen evidence that they have plans in place to reverse the declines in public services that we've seen. You know, if public services are poor in the rest of the UK in terms of health waiting lists, for example, they are so much worse here. If the problems with infrastructure, the problems with water quality are bad in the rest of the UK, they are worse in Northern Ireland. So we have the same difficulties, only on a bigger scale. And we haven't seen a plan from our politicians about what they're going to do about those things.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Unfortunately, we haven't had time to talk about Oasis today. Isn't that a pity? I hear all these people talking about how glorious it'll be to have Oasis back. We think there's slightly more news around than that. Some of the team disagree with me. I don't really care about Oasis. That's my wee secret. We'll leave you today with the words from the Prime Minister, the worrying words from the Prime Minister.
I will be honest with you. There is a budget coming in October, and it's going to be painful. We have no other choice, given the situation that we're in. Those with the broadest shoulders should bear the heavier burden. And that's why we're cracking down on non-doms. Those who made the mess should have to do their bit to clean it up. And that's why we're strengthening the powers of the water regulator and backing tough fines on the water companies that have let sewage flood our rivers, lakes and seas. Just as when I responded to the riots, I'll have to turn to the country and make big asks of you as well. To accept short-term pain for long-term good. The difficult trade-off for the genuine solution.
Listen again. We'll see you tomorrow. BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.